I've been announced a lot of ways, and that's probably one of the best. I sat there and I thought, please, Terry, don't do that. I'm going to start crying before I start talking. My name is Kevin Barksdale, and I'm a very grateful recovering alcoholic. There you go, right there. I love you fellas, and I'm so glad to be here tonight. And Tara asked me this afternoon if I was nervous, and she said, don't you tell me you're not nervous. And I said, well, maybe that's not the best word. And she said, I knew it. I knew you would be able to say you're nervous. And then later I said, well, if being calm and then every now and then your heart going into your throat means you're nervous, then that's what I am. Tom and I spent some time together last night, and as I was getting ready to go back over to my room, I came in here and I stood at the podium, and I've stood up here many times before, and I've seen all of your faces, and I know how much each one of you mean to me, and I know that there's nothing but love in this room, and I've never felt anything but that. But as I stood here, I could look and I could see people as they were sitting right where they sit tonight. I said, you know, I can see Jim and Mickey sitting right here and Bob and Juanita right here. And I just started going down the line. And I know that Sheila and Roe always sit here. And I could look back and I could, in my mind, see Grady and Ann and Phil and Dottie on the left. And then I could go on around and all. And I went back to my room and I did a little work on what I wanted to say tonight. And I went to bed. And I woke up sometime in the middle of the night. And I knew I'd had a nightmare. And it just dawned on me that I'd made my talk and it was already over. And I couldn't, no control over what I was going to say. None whatsoever. I think that I bring to you tonight a message of experience, strength, and hope. My experience is what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. That's what the book tells us. My strength is what I do today to live this life and what I do to stay sober. A friend of mine that I met in Memphis, and he's been a lot of help to me since I've moved there in the last year, told me something one time, and I really love it, and I've held on to it. We were talking about some meetings that we were going to, and he looked up at me and said, I don't stay sober by accident. And I knew exactly what he was talking about. I knew exactly what he was talking about. And the hope that I'd like to bring tonight is for three different groups of people. One hope is for the people who were here when I came in. That you opened the doors and you opened your arms to me and you loved me and you showed me your way of life. The hope there that what you had and what you allowed and what you gave to me will be here long after many of us are gone. The second group of people is for the people who come behind me, and that is the hope that no matter what you think about the conditions you find yourself in when you come into AA or Al-Anon, that things will get better. And that there is anything you want to do can be done right here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the third I bring it to is myself, and that is to know that in a little while this will be over and I can get on with being what I'm supposed to be. The most important day of my life, short of my birthday, which was March 28th, 1961, which makes me 34, was November 28th, 1982. And that's the day that I woke up in the morning after almost 2.5 years of being in and out of this program, and I knew that the gig was up. I knew that I had to stop drinking. How did I know that? All I can tell you is that just like it says in the book, John Barleycorn had become my greatest advocate. I'd been in and out of AA for 2.5 years, had had a year and a half of sobriety almost at one point, and decided that other things were more important and quit going to meetings. And lo and behold, we know what happens to folks who don't go to meetings. I found myself drunk. And over a 13-month period before that day, when I woke up that morning, over that period of time, I came to know the degradation and despair that I had only been able to imagine when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I understand today what it says when it talks about the four hideous horsemen, terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. And if you've been where I've been, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Probably the best thing I can do to tell you who I am, other than talk just a minute about my family, is to tell you a little story. I found myself today, and this is before I came of age, what I was like before I came of age. I found myself later on this afternoon, I was standing out on the grounds, and I had walked all the way to the corner fence, the closest point you can be to the road without leaving the grounds of the DuBose Conference Center. And I was standing there, and what I was doing was waiting for my wife and for my dad to come up. Now, this is before I came of age. This is the way I thought about things, is if I can get close to where it's happening, it'll happen faster. Now, me being up there at the farthest point on the grounds weren't going to get Mama, Dad up here any faster or Lisa up any faster, but that's the way I live my life. The closer I can get to the action, the better it can be. Now, after I came of age at about the age of 5, I lost that sweet innocence. I lost that innocence as I began to understand, as I began to think for myself and explored feelings in myself and began to think that I was thinking things that nobody else thought. All the thoughts that many of us thought that made me come to believe that I was different from everybody else and that I didn't fit. Now, why that happened at 4 or 5 years old, somewhere near, who knows? But all I can tell you is that set the tone for the rest of my life. And it was only once I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and several years into sobriety and a lot of work that changed for me. And I have returned many days to the point where, like today, I could walk all the way out to the corner and wait on my family, wait on the people I love to get here, and feel like the closer I can get to the action, the better it'll be. And the closer I can be, it's going to make it happen that much faster. I was born the 3rd of 3 sons to Jim and Virginia Barksdale from Birmingham, Alabama. My father was the son of a West Tennessee farmer, and my mother was a daughter of a Cumberland Presbyterian minister, and I was given all the tools that I would ever need to live my life. Our home was not perfect, no home is, but everything I needed, I got, and many of the things I wanted were there for me. I had 2 older brothers, and both of them were overachievers. Just to tell you a little bit about them, because they're very important to me. My oldest brother is a medical doctor. My middle brother is a certified accountant. And years later in sobriety, I became a PhD. What does that tell you about growing up in our household, being overachievers and kind of pushing things to the wall? I worshiped the ground my oldest brother walked on, and I'll tell you one real quick story, and it leads kind of into my drinking, because this was the last period of my life before I really began to find alcohol. Was the happiest day of my life was the day that he won the state championship as a high school wrestler in Alabama, and I watched him for 2 years. I never missed a match. Dad would take me out of school so we could go watch my brother wrestle, and he became an important part of my life. And years later, when I wrestled, I never was able to achieve what he could achieve, and alcohol played a big role in that. First drink I took, I was 15 years old. If you're looking for a long drunk log tonight, it's just not going to happen, because I only drank 6 years and I just couldn't do that much, you know. You can only do so much in 6 years' time. Now, you're going to hear from my dad tomorrow, but you can do a lot in 6 years. But what I can tell you is that from the first time the first drink that I took, like many of you, and you know, all I know is that something happened and I felt better and I liked it. And I drank from the very first time I drank. I had no control over how much I drank. And within about 3 or 4 months of the first drink that I took, I was in blackouts and I was in jail. You know, and I'll never forget. In fact, it was on Friday night, Friday the 13th, I was at dinner with Mom and Dad and the rest of the family, and I had planned a drunk that night. I was working for a skating rink, and this part of the story I had completely forgotten, but I remember sitting at dinner thinking to myself, it's probably not too smart what you've got planned tonight, because what I was going to do was supposed to be going midnight bowling after I got off of work at midnight that night. And I knew before I left dinner table that I had lied to them, and that what I was going to do was at midnight I was going to go with my friend and we were going to start drinking. And what we ended up doing was in jail the next morning. You know, and that was a story of my life. And I did something that I came to understand and came to appreciate as the misery of my drinking for many times after that point. And a lot of you will know this, waking up the next morning, laying in bed. In my house, I was upstairs. And I would lay in bed and I would listen for the voices. Are they talking about me? What are they saying? What am I going to face when I go down the stairs? What am I going to hear? What am I going to have to listen to? Not wanting to feel the guilt, not wanting to know, and not wanting to face what I had done the night before. And that happened many times. I came to a point where I would dread getting out of bed in the morning because I didn't know what I'd done the night before. You know, and I remember at 17, I was in high school, and I had a car that I'd wanted so bad. And it was a Camaro, and it was sleek and pretty, and I had cleaned it up real good. And buddy of mine and I had gone and bought a fifth of whiskey, and we were going to have a little drink that night, and we started drinking, and sometime into the early into the evening, the rum was gone, the entire fifth was gone, and apparently, I know nothing about this story, I only know what people have told me. A guy saw us driving down the road, and he thought that we looked like we were crazy because we were driving all over the road. And so he started following us, and he said, "I hit a bump in the road," and he said, "It looked like your foot went through the floor and never let up." And something about 4 miles down the road, after apparently swerving all over the road, because I didn't know, I'm not conscious of any of this, I slid off the road on Shades Mountain and into the fire ditches. They had had fires that summer across the top of Shades Mountain in Birmingham, slid off the road and into a fire ditch. By all estimates, we don't know how fast I was going, but it was as fast as that car would go because I put my foot to the floor and never let up. And getting dragged in, and they took me down, some friends of mine found us, took me down to a place, tried to sober me up. My dad found me, and we went home, and as we were going home, he took me by my car where they had towed it in, and it took him about an hour and a half to tow it 4 miles. It was in such bad shape, and I looked at it. Actually, somebody else had taken me by. Dad wasn't with me, and I looked at that car, and I was so drunk, and I looked at it, and I'll say, "Don't, it's not too bad. Dad and I'll come up here tomorrow and fix it, and I'll drive it home." That's how drunk I was. So, that's the kind of thing that I did, and that was the way it went. I mean, my social drinking was over before it ever started. One story I'll tell you real quick that a friend of mine wrote in my high school annual. I'll never forget this. I looked at it after she wrote it, and I couldn't believe she put it in there for everybody else to see. She said, "You're really a great guy, but you lose it when you drink. You can't handle it. Why don't you try drugs?" Honest truth. Honest truth. I made it through. I want to tell you about one event that happened in high school that has come to mean so much to me later on. One day I was at school, and like many days, I was drunk when I got to school that morning. It was early in the morning, and a buddy of mine and I got in a little trouble. He got mad at a teacher, and we were both really drunk by this. It's 8 or 8:30 in the morning, and we were seniors in high school, and he got mad and ran out of the room, and dumb me, I get up and run off behind him, and they didn't even know I was in, they didn't know I was drinking, they just knew he was drinking, and I got up and followed him, and we left, and we came back to school, and we're going to quit school, and our principal took us aside and grabbed us and took us back into her office, and she talked to us that day, and she told us she wanted us to stay in school, and here I was just as drunk as I could be, and I remember looking up at her, and I told her, I said, "I don't understand why you're doing this for me," and she said, "Because you're worth it. Because you're worth it." And if you're anything like me, you know how I felt when she said that. Because I knew I wasn't worth it. I knew I wasn't worth it. Things at home weren't going too good either, as you can well imagine. I don't know if by this point in time, 17 or 18, if Dad and I were back on speaking terms or not. We had had a period in there for 6 or 8 months. It was probably the hardest time that I can imagine for him and for Mother both, that I couldn't talk to him. I would come home drunk and I wouldn't say anything, and we wouldn't speak. And then shortly, sometime after that period, all during high school, I got to a point where I would come home drunk and I would lay down and I would talk to him and I would tell him. Of course, I was drunk, and you know what that means. It didn't mean a thing to me, but I would tell him, "I know I can't control my drinking, or I would tell him, I can handle it," or anything just to talk to get the focus in my mind off of whatever it was that was going on, because I came home drunk. I was a control drunk. I came home at midnight every night because that was my curfew, and I think Dad knew that if I wasn't home by midnight, I was in serious trouble. I'd either wreck my car or I was in jail, because I had learned for some reason that as long as I got, why alcoholics, we get these things in our mind. It's just like thinking that if you drink vodka, it doesn't stink, right? Well, it's the same thing. I would think that if I made it home by midnight, everything was going to be okay. And I was just locked into that thing and I couldn't get out of it. But I knew, watching my friends, that I was drinking different from them, because when we would go somewhere, they would drink and they'd put it down. And I didn't want to put it down. Well, two car wrecks later, same car, by the way. The first one never did get repaired. But two car wrecks later, I ended up in Peachford Hospital in Atlanta, Georgia, from Birmingham. Now let me tell you a little bit about that. I've always said over the years that I volunteered to go, and that's not completely honest. Now the truth is that I knew good and well that they had been on me about my drinking, and they were getting ready to do something about it. And when I got home that night and I'd wrecked my car, and there was no car in the driveway, I knew, you know, and I'm looking back at this now, and obviously this is with hindsight, but I knew that I was going to have to do something, and I better go ahead and just tell them I'd go to treatment. It was the easy way out, because that way I wouldn't have to stay and live through the guilt. I wouldn't have to face them. I've been running away from my own actions all my life. And in alcoholism, it just became that much worse. I ran away from everything I'd ever done. Well, I went to the hospital there, and by the way, that was April 16th, 1980. And that was my first brush with Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was not quite a month after my 19th birthday. And if you add that up, I really, by that point, hadn't been drinking more than 3.5 years. And I've only touched the surface of the kind of drinking that I did. I stayed there for 42 days, and I talked a lot, and I don't think I learned a lot. I learned a lot, but it didn't sink in, and I really didn't know what y'all know. It didn't register. And so many of you know, you've seen it in your own lives, you've seen it in other people. It didn't register with me that I was an alcoholic. Hey, Tony, I'm so glad to see you. Well, I got back to Birmingham after that treatment center, and while I was gone, Dad had worked hard to have my car ready for when I got home, and when I got there it sat in the driveway, and it was painted, and it was fresh, and it was repaired from the drunk wreck that I had had. And over a period of the next 60 or 90 days, I continued to drink on and off. I made it a couple of weeks and started drinking again. And I drank to a point where one night I was in way too drunk and driving again, and I wrecked that car again, that car that Dad had worked so hard to fix and set up. And I got home, and Dad was out of town, and Mom was there, and I was drunk. Boy, I mean, you know how you get when you just, you walk drunk, you smell drunk, you talk drunk. And she looked at me. She came into my bedroom and knocked on my door, and she looked at me, and she smelled the whiskey on my breath, and she said, you know, you got to understand now from the boy hearing this from his mama. She said, you're nothing but a low-down, filthy, stinking drunk. And she turned around and walked away. And I closed my door, and I heard her crying the rest of the night. And that's what I heard. You know, and I lay there, and by this point, I'm going to be honest with you. I'd been to treatment centers. I'd been to AA meetings, and I didn't know what was wrong with me. I still didn't know what was wrong. I couldn't quit drinking, and it hadn't registered that if you don't drink, you're not going to get drunk. It really hadn't all sunk in. Well, that car wreck kind of did it, and I ended up stopping, and I got involved in AA for a good while, for about 15 months, in fact. And I stopped drinking. This was still in 1980, and I stopped drinking in state stops from July of 1980 to November of 1981. So I had about 15 months when I drank again. And during that 15 months, I learned a lot about AA. I met a guy in Birmingham, Judd B., who taught me about this program, and he taught me the basic principles that are with me today. But there came a point when I got tired of going to meetings. I got tired of being there early. I got tired of talking to people. I got tired of doing all that. I was ready to get on with my life. It's just like that story in the Big Book where that guy says, thank you very much for the information. You know, now that you've told me all this, I think I can handle it. Well, that was the way I was. You know, I mean, I didn't know that at the time, but that's the way I thought about it. And for you Al-Anons, my favorite Al-Anon story is during that period of time, I started seeing this woman, this girl, and there was an Al-Anon. Now, Al-Anon and AA have changed, by the way, over the years. You know, not in every city, not every location, but it used to be that Al-Anons and AAs almost always met in the same meeting place. And there was a lot of intermingling before and after meetings. And Al-Anons took as just as much a role in working with the new alcoholics from the fringe now, not sponsoring them, but these Al-Anons were where I was getting sober. I mean, they got involved with the alcoholics. They knew who you were because their husband was your sponsor. And you know, and you'd go over there and they'd feed you and stuff you full of food so you could, you're so full you couldn't drink maybe, but they were involved. And this woman walks up and it's changing. It's not everywhere, but it's changing from that. And that's something I want to talk about later. But this woman walked up to me, Martha Ed A., and she walked up to me and she said, "Kevin, you know there's a slip under every skirt." Now, what do you think I thought she was talking about? Do you think it was about this? I thought she, you know, I didn't think she was talking about that by chasing this girl that I might get drunk. It never registered. I thought she was just telling me that there's a slip, you know, that women wear slips under their skirts. It never registered. Well, long, you know, in there, I started drinking again. And I'll tell you the thought that I had. And many of you have heard this, but so many of you hadn't. And I want those of you who hadn't to know, you know, there's so much I want to tell you, so much I want to tell the people that have been so much a part of my life up here on the mountain. But I remember I was treasurer of this group, in a group that I'd helped start in Birmingham for people that there wasn't any place for young people to go in 1981, if you don't remember. If you weren't able to go to Alcoholics Anonymous, there was nowhere else for you to turn. And I remember going to this meeting, and I was a treasurer there, and I went in and I turned in my resignation because I wasn't running the thing very well, if you can imagine. And I can tell you exactly how much it was because I had to go back later and pay restitution. $54. And I went in and I turned in the books and everything, and I turned the corner from the church, and as I drove away, I found a 7-Eleven store over in the corner, and I went to that store and I walked inside and I bought 2 16-ounce beers, and I remember thinking I ought to open both of them at once. You know, now why, I don't know, I guess so I can drink more. But I opened that first one and I turned it up, and the first thought that came out of my mouth, and if you've been sober before and you drank again, you're going to know exactly what I'm talking about. My God, I've released a vicious animal, because I knew that there was nothing going to stop me then. And I turned right back around and walked right back in that store and bought 2 6-packs. There was no pretense in my mind once I picked that next drink up that I was going to be able to control my drinking, because I knew it wasn't going to happen. I knew it wasn't going to happen. And I think that was the beginning of me realizing. Now, it took me 13 months after that day. It took me 13 months. And I found a lot of other things. And I did a lot of other things besides drinking. But, you know, this is an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and I have learned over the years that what's appropriate for me to say here is what we can all relate to, and all of it works together for the good, and you open your loving arms to me, and you accept me the way I was, and what I've learned about that is that means that I try to fit in with you. I don't try to change you. Because what you had when I got here was working long before I got here. Long before I got here. But I learned about a lot of other things in that period of time. And during that 13 months, I used a lot of different things. And all these things happened to me where what happened is AA had changed my drinking, by the way, if you don't realize that. I had been a daily drinker in high school and that first year out of college. But when I came to AA, I left here, and I left here as a binge drinker. I left here as a binge drinker. I came here as a daily, and I left here as a binge drinker. And what would happen is I would get sober out of guilt or whatever for 8 days, 10 days, 2 weeks, even a month. And then the thought of a drink would cross my mind. And once that thought came in, just like the book said, once the thought of a drink came through my mind, everything else was pushed aside until I picked up that next drink. And what I would do would be to drink until I was physically unable to drink anymore. And sometimes that meant 3 days, sometimes that meant 7 days. And I would go without sleep, I would go without brushing my teeth. You know the drill. You know, and here I was 20 years old, and I'd go for days on end without brushing my teeth, without sleeping, without bathing. And I got pretty sick, as you can imagine. And to end that story, I woke up on November 28th, 1982, after having been on a binge with money that I'd stolen from my mother and father. And I knew that it was over. I had been out the night before, and while I was gone, my father had come looking for me because I worked for the police department. They wanted to know where I was, and I wasn't showing up to work. And my father had been there in the time that I was gone to drink, and he had left a letter for me there. And he said in that letter something to the effect of, "Son, we love you. We know you're sick. And when you want to get well, we're here to help you." And when I walked into that bathroom and I looked in that mirror, and you know what I saw? For some reason, I knew all those times in the past when I'd gone to them and asked them to help me, this time I knew that I was going to have to do it myself. Now, I don't know why I knew that. The only thing I can tell you is God was working in my life from the morning that I woke up. And I knew that I was going to have to do it myself this time, that I wasn't going to be able to go back to Mom and Dad and ask them to pick me up and dust me off, that if I was going to make it, I was going to have to do it on my own. And I don't think I thought that I was going to do it without AA, but I just knew that I couldn't go back to them and ask them one more time to pick me up and clean me off. So I got on the phone, called around, tried to find a place to go there to dry out because I knew I was never going to sober up on my own. They couldn't take me, and I ended up back in Atlanta. And Phil Mack came to see me that morning on November 28th, that afternoon. I finally made it in. He came to see me, and he looked at me, and he said, you know, when I first met you 2 years ago, I wondered if you were an alcoholic or not. He said, today I'm convinced. He laughed. I didn't. He laughed, and I didn't. And the next thing he said after he walked out of that room, and he didn't stay long. Typical 12-step call. He came in, I was in the detox, and he came in and he made a few comments, and he left. Before he left, he said this one thing: you're going to have to find a power greater than yourself that you can believe in. Now, I don't know why he said that. And I've been with him on 12-step calls since then, and he hadn't always said that. But you know, what I've learned since then is that if you practice what we know, and it's in the book, and it's also handed down from generation to generation from other alcoholics, if you practice that, you know that every time you go on a 12-step call, you may say something a little different. You talk to the person in the condition in which they're in. If they're happy, you tell funny stories. If you're sad, you tell sad stories. You meet the conditions that you find when you go in the room. You don't try to force them to be something they're not. And I was sad and I was depressed, and he looked at me and he told me that I was going to have to find a power I could believe in. And I believe that what I've done since that day, in one form or another, is I've spent the last 12 and a half years trying to find that, seeking that. What getting sober was like for me was really hard. I came here kicking and screaming. Even though I was sick and I didn't want to drink anymore, and God had given me that moment where I made that choice, it was hard for me. I was 21 years old, and I couldn't imagine living a life without alcohol. You know, it's hard to believe that, if you think it is for me today, it boggles my mind that in just a few short years I could come to the point that I came to, that I couldn't imagine life without alcohol. And I'm going to tell you why I think that happened. I'd been sober about 5 years, and one night we were doing a step study and we were looking at 12 and 12. And in there, at some point in the first step, if you've read it, you know that it talks about how years after the early AAs came in, you learned how to raise the bottom for many of us who came in after you, who didn't go to the lengths that some of you did. That you learned how to do that, and you did that for me. And then it says that many of us, we raise the bottom for them. You go back, I'm paraphrasing and I'm not, you go back out, but you come back in ready to go, totally defeated years before you might have been in any other way. And I believe that what happened to me is that during that time when I came here, you raised the bottom, I heard you. It didn't register maybe consciously. I drank, and when I came back, I was ready. Years before, sparing me that last 10 to 15 years of literal hell that the book describes and that all of us know. I experienced that 10 to 15 years in that 15 months, because when I came back, I was beaten and I was ready to listen. But I was fighting it too. I was mad. I knew I wanted to stop, but I was angry. So it wasn't easy for me, and I was scared. I was afraid I was going to drink again. I was afraid that something was going to happen and I was going to pick up that drink and I'd be off again, that I wouldn't make it. After all those times that I had not been able to stay sober, I was afraid this wouldn't be any different from any of the others. Some of the things that happened during that time, I had a 1-2 punch sponsor combination. I had Tom and I had Phil. Tom and I would be out in the parking lot in the evenings after the meeting, and we would be sitting eye to eye, toe to toe, nose to nose, and the spit would just be flying back and forth as he would be yelling at me, and I'd yell back at him and tell him how crazy I thought he was and that he didn't know what he was talking about. He'd tell me if I didn't listen to him, I was going to get drunk. And you know what happened in all of that? Is that we both stayed sober. He'd get mad and I'd get mad. He'd call Phil, I'd call Phil. Phil tell us both to calm down, everything was going to be all right. But what happened is we both stayed sober during that process, and here we are all these years later, and he's one of the best friends I have in this whole world. He's one of the best friends I have in this whole world. And we've walked through a lot together. We've walked through a lot together. Some other things that happened that I think are kind of interesting is that, I didn't like the job I had. I was digging ditches for a living, and I was working for David B. See, there's a lot of people in this room, and every one of you has had an important role, and I was working for David B. digging ditches for Blue, and I didn't like it too much. Part of the reason I didn't like it is because he was an alcoholic and he was sober, and I was an alcoholic and I was sober, and he was sitting in the truck and I was out in the ditch digging. As soon as the boss would pull up, and he had a knack for getting out of the truck just in time before the boss got there. But I remember telling Phil, Tom, and everybody, I hated doing this. I hated digging those ditches. I didn't like it. When am I ever going to be able to get out of the ditches? And you know the typical AA line, they said, as soon as you quit asking when you can leave there is when you'll be able to leave that. And I remember going home one weekend and praying, and I finally, Monday morning I woke up. This was on a Friday. On Monday morning I woke up, and I knew I was going to go in there that day, and I was going to accept whatever came. And I've been sober, 7 or 8 months. I was going to accept whatever happened, and I was going to be okay digging ditches. If that's what it took, as long as I didn't drink, I'd dig ditches the rest of my life. And I walked in that morning, and they offered me a job in the shop off the ditch, ditch line. How true it is, and so many other stories I can tell you just like that. The time that I was living in a halfway house, and they were looking to raise a few funds, and I didn't have much money, but I saved, and I learned how to set milestones for myself sober, and I did something, and I told this in a talk not long ago, that what I did was I had this coffee cup that somebody had given me, and I never drank out of it. And what I did was I put it over here in this corner. And every time I'd come home, when I had quarters in my pocket, I'd put them over in that jug. And in about a 6-month period of time, I had a couple of $100 saved up, from quarters and everything. And I remember Dad coming over to visit one night, and me looking at him and showing him. I said, "Let me show you something I'm so proud of. Look what I've done in the last 6 months. I've saved this little bit of money, And I know that sounds kind of, it may kind of sound kind of silly, but that was a big thing to me, because I had been so wasteful and I'd been so undisciplined, and I had no self-control. And so during that period of time, I'd found that. Something that I was pretty good at was saving money. I can't help it. But what happened was that... What happened was that over time, I lost that thing. It's gone. Yeah, it just fell right out. I hadn't cried with my contacts in a long time. I was thinking the other day about something I'd never told this. I told you that my parents gave me a lot of tools, and they carried me to church. They carried me to church every Sunday, and they wanted me to go when I was in Sunday school and I was in church. And, I didn't always like it, but a lot of times I did, and I learned a lot while I was there. But one of the things I learned to appreciate in that church was music. And during that first year I was sober, I would drive home from Atlanta to Birmingham, and I was so scared, so afraid I was going to drink again, because I really still didn't believe this was real. I really didn't. And I remembering all those songs, and I would drive down the highway and I would sing those songs just as loud as I could, because I knew that if I could sing those songs, it would make me not afraid. And it worked. And you want to know something funny? 12 years later, I still do it. 12 years later, I still do it. Something important happened to me during that period of time. I met Mont Eagle. Mont Eagle met me, and y'all opened your doors to me. And I was about a year sober, and I came up here, and I thought I was going to have fun. And I got up here, and there wasn't any young people. I was it. All of y'all were married, and very few single people. And the first time I came up here, if you'd asked me you're going to come back, and I'd told you no way will I ever go back up there, no way. I was hard headed. I had started back to school right before this first Mont Eagle trip that I came to, and I called Phil. I'd wanted to go back to college for a long time. I called Phil and I said, "Phil, I don't think I'm going to be able to go to Mont Eagle, even though I've sent in my money, because I've got a paper to write that weekend, or I've got a test to take on that following Monday." And he said, "Now don't start getting your priorities out of order already." I came up to Mont Eagle that weekend and I brought my books and I studied like I've done for 10 years since then while I was in school. And I brought my books and I did a little bit of studying. And I thought I'd never come back. I went home on Monday or Sunday, and then on Monday I took that test and I got it back and I made an A. I made such a high A that the professor came to me and said, "I don't see any reason for you to come back and take the final." And it taught me a great lesson. It taught me about putting priorities in order. It taught me that as long as I do what I need to do to stay sober, if I'll put that in front. And notice I didn't say, as long as I go to meetings, because that's just a part of it. I said, if I'll put my sobriety first, if I'll do the things I got to do to stay sober, everything else takes care of itself. But I would come up to Mont Eagle, I guess the second or third time, and I was finally beginning to feel at least a little bit like I knew folks. And Jim and Mickey and Bob and Juanita and so many of you that have come all these years. And I want to tell you a funny story. I would come out here and I was still afraid. I was learning and I was struggling and I was taking inventories and I was writing and I was sharing, but I was still afraid. And that fear came out in anger and I didn't know how to live. And I would walk that track out here. Y'all all know it because many of you have done it. I would walk it. And Jim would be standing out front out there in front of that door. And you know how he does? Many times after dinner, he'll walk out there and just stand. And he and George or somebody would be standing there talking. And I'd walk and I'd think, in a minute now, Jim's going to come over and talk to me and tell me what to do. Any minute now, he's going to come over and fix my problems. Any minute now, he's going to, you know, and I'd walk and sure enough, you know, he wouldn't say anything. It wasn't that he was ignoring me. Now, I'm not implying that. I'm not even telling a story on Jim. I'm actually going to make a point. What I finally realized, and it took me a long time after that, is that if I wanted Jim's help, I needed to go ask him for it. He had no way of knowing that I wanted him to talk to me unless I walked up to him and said, "Jim, can you talk to me for a minute?" You know, and it's taken me a long time now. Now, I know that lots of times I intuitively walk up to somebody and I look at them and I say, "I know they need help." Had that happen to me one time. I was 2 years sober, not quite 2 years sober, and we were over at Norcross at a meeting one night, and there's a spiritual experience happened to me. I was getting ready to go drink. I'd broken up with this girl, and I was mad. I was hurt. I was confused. I was going to 7 meetings a week. I was going to school at night, and I was working hard, and I didn't feel any better. And I had made up my mind that when I left that meeting that night, I was going to get drunk. And we were standing in the hallway at the old Norcross meeting in Atlanta, and Phil was standing there. And he looked over at me, and we were talking for just a minute, real briefly. And, of course, I wasn't saying much, because if you're getting ready to go drink, you don't say much, right? And Dottie walked up to him and said, "Phil, are you ready to go?" And Phil looked up at me, and he said, "No, I see a drunk standing in front of me." He knew. How did he know? How did he know? How did any of us ever know? I'd not be standing here tonight if that happened. Now, he didn't cause that. It's not just Phil. But how did he know that was going to happen? Because I was gone. There was no way I was going to stay. What I did was we talked, and I went down to the monastery down in Atlanta, and I took another inventory, and I came back, and I talked about it. And I talked with him about it for a long time. And when we were done, was I fixed? No. Did I feel 1,000 times better? No. But I didn't drink. And I knew myself a little better. I knew myself a little better. So many things have happened in my sobriety. You know, I was telling you that we hear a lot of times in meetings, people say sometimes the only kind of restitution we can make to our family and the closest friends in our lives is to stay sober. Yeah, I heard that. You know, I can. And sometimes you can even go to them and you can try to talk about it, but then you know the best thing you can do is to stay sober. And you'll hear that said in meetings. And I want to tell you about 4 stories that'll tell you that that's not the whole story. That's not page two. That's just the first page. That mother and father. Well, yeah, I'll tell you that one first. The mother and father that we had struggled so hard through my alcoholism, and my mother and I were always at odds, and we didn't understand each other, and I couldn't stop drinking, and she and I just could. And Dad and I were very close. He followed me right to the gates of insanity and stood there. And as a friend of mine said, he followed you to the gates of hell, stood there, held the door open, and waited for you to come back out. And what I did in that period of time is I loved them, and I went home and I was with them, and I would go home and stay with them for holidays and things, and I was trying to do the things that AA says to do. But there came a day on July 9th, 1989, when I'd gone to a meeting with Tom. Tom had spoken at a meeting the night before, and I had tried to call them, as I do almost every Sunday night, as I have since I've been sober. And I tried to call them, and nobody answered, and I knew something was wrong. Well, I got up the next morning and went to work, and I called the church where my mother worked, and another lady answered the telephone, and I said, "I'm looking to talk to my mother. Do you know where she is?" And she said, "Don't you know it's awful about that accident?" And this was the first I had heard. Mother and Dad had been down to Tuscaloosa to see my grandmother, who was elderly and ailing, and they had had a terrible car accident, and they were both injured seriously in the hospital. Well, I was pretty upset, as you can imagine, and I got in the car from Atlanta, and I told my boss, "I'll see you." I called my graduate school professor that I was going to school with, and that's another story altogether. And I told him I wasn't going to be in class. I'm going to take care of my mother and my father. And I got in the car from Atlanta, and I drove over there, and I got in, and the first thing I did was I saw my father and saw that he was okay, and I said, "I want to see my mother." And they took me back to the intensive care where she was, and she was in bad shape. She was hurt really bad. And what I want to tell you about restitution is that for the next week, I stayed in that hospital, and I did things for my mother that most sons don't get to do for their mother. She needed me to be there and take care of her and hold her hand and tell her it was going to be okay and to be with my father and listen to him and share with him. And I would stay at my aunt's house and get up in the morning at 7 in the morning and be at the hospital and then leave at 10 that night. Now, did I make it any better? I don't know. But I'll tell you one thing. My relationship with my mother has not been the same since that week. It has not been the same. Why? I don't know. If it was that, if it was whatever it was, it's not been the same since that week. Now, just staying sober was half the story. When they needed me, they had always been there for me. When they needed me, I had to be there for them. Another story, that high school principal that I told you about. Not quite a year ago, I had spent 4.5 years in graduate school working on a PhD in sober. Can you imagine that? And I got to thinking about that principal, and I had talked about her in a story one time, and I told it in a story. And I got home, and I was sitting there thinking, I'm going to write Miss Pritchett a letter, and I'm going to tell her what's happened to me. And I'm going to tell her what I've done since that day. And I typed up a long letter, and I told her about my alcoholism, and I told her about coming to Alcoholics Anonymous and finding sobriety and going back to college and staying in college for, 8 years in sobriety, studying and coming to Mount Eagle and studying while I was up here and going back home and taking tests and doing well and chairing meetings and leading meetings and helping other alcoholics get sober and the things that I was doing during that period of time. And I told her that in less than 10 days I'm going to be hooded as Dr. William Kevin Barksdale, and I want you to know that when you told me that day that I wasn't worth it, that I was worth it, I knew I wasn't. And I want to tell you today that I know I was. And I want to thank you. Well, she wrote me a letter back to thank me for it. And she told me a story of her own about her own daughter having her own problems. And how that week she was being hooded as a PhD. And she had a job going off. And she had lived the same kind of life I had. Now, the sad part of that story is about 2 weeks later, she went to the doctor and found out she had cancer. And I called my mother. My mother called me and told me she wanted me to know. And she said, "I just want you to know." She said, "You don't need to call her and talk to her about it." Because she called me and she told me that you had given me all. She said you had given her the best present she could have when you wrote that letter and told her what you were doing. The next thing that happened, there's all kinds, and I'm going to tell a funny story in a minute. I can't help it. Y'all just do this to me. And this is not even a funny story. This is a glorious story, so I'll tell it in a glorious fashion. About 2 years ago, see, I still got time. I'm well under, I'm doing good. About two and a half years ago, I was going to grad school, and I was living across the street from this guy that I noticed one day he was sick. He was in a wheelchair, and it was my next-door neighbor. And I went over there. Something inside me told me, I got to go find out what's wrong. And found out he, my age, 34, had been diagnosed with a brain tumor. And it was a sad story, and he was really sick. And I told him, I said, you know, I live at home. I work at home a lot. And if you need me, why don't you call me, and I'll come over, and I'll be of help to you. Well, it took 3 or 4 months, but one day they called me and they came over and they asked me if I could come over and help. And over the next period, about 2 years, a year and a half, I came to become very close to this man and his family. And I was there, and I even had my schedule. 2 nights a week, I would go over and help put him to bed. You know, if you've worked on that kind of vigil, you know what some of those things are like. But he and I became very close, and you know, he could barely speak. But he was alive, and you know what happened is he would look at me, and he would try to talk, and what we had was a language of the heart. I didn't even have to say a word to him. We would just share. I would just hold his hand, and I would tell him, Bobby, I know, you know, and he would look at me, and we didn't have to say anything. Well, we moved to, long story short, when he passed away, I want to tell you, it was a sad day. We knew it was coming, you know, when those things happen, you know they're coming, and when he passed away, all I can tell you is that for the first time in my life, I understood things in a way that I never understood them before, because as I was driving home from his funeral, heading back to Memphis from Atlanta, I looked over in the seat next to me, and there he sat. And he was healthy, and he was feeling good, and I knew that he was there. The part that I can appreciate so much is one day I went over to help, and his wife looked up at me and said, you know you're our guardian angel. She said, you know you're our guardian. Now think about that. From where I came from, can you imagine that? This is the same guy who wrecked a car going 110 miles an hour on the top of a mountain. The same guy who caused his mother to cry herself to sleep every night. And the same one that caused his dad to go crazy trying to do something about his drinking. Incredible story. Incredible story. Well, about a year ago, right before we were getting ready to leave to come to Memphis from Atlanta, Lisa had, and I were struggling, you know, trying to get ready to move and everything. And one day she tricked me into going to this place for dinner, and it turned out that they had put together, among all my friends, a surprise going away party. And what was so neat about it is the four corners of my life were represented at this meeting. The four corners of my life. My wife and my brother and my father were there in one corner. My AA friends, about 20 of them, were sitting over here. Some of them I'd sponsored. All of them I'd seen come in the doors. And over here in another corner was a guy that I'd spent 4 or 5 years with working out, my workout partner. And over in another corner was my major professor, the lady who trained me for my PhD. And it was a great thing. We had so much fun, and they surprised me, and they shocked me with it. And I looked at it, and I thought, you know, what a great testimony to my life and to what's happened to us. I thought of a couple of things that I wanted to kind of close on. One is that being young, coming into AA young and not knowing what path to take, it's been a struggle. It's been a real struggle sometimes, not knowing, you know, deciding what to do, whether I should stay home and study tonight or go to a meeting. And a lot of times I made the decision to go to a meeting, and a lot of times I made the decision to stay home and study. But, you know, other things that have happened was getting married sober and getting married to somebody who never saw me take a drink. And if you don't think that's interesting, trying to get someone involved in Alcoholics Anonymous that's never, you know, that she couldn't, you know, when we met and I finally told her, it wasn't too long after we were dating that I told her, because I said, if you want to go out with me on Friday night, you're going to have to go to a meeting, because that's where I'm going to be at 8 o'clock. You know what I said? And she went to meetings with me for a long time. The first 2 or 3 years we were just dating, she showed up and would go to meetings, and she started coming to Mont Eagle, and she's been a part of my life up here for a long time. Well, we struggle a lot, and I struggle with carrying this program to my home. And I know many of you do. I struggle with it. I have to work real hard at it, and I have to work real hard to let her have her own life and let her have her own problems and know when it's my place to get involved and know when it's not. And you know how I learn when those times are is I can't do it on my own. I spent a long time trying to do that. I found that I'm going to have to talk to people about it. And I have to share with them and I have to do it by talking with other people. I don't get acceptance by sitting down and thinking, oh Lord, please help me accept this. That's part of it. But what I first do is I have to talk to somebody to find out what it is I'm really fighting. I have to talk to somebody and find out what it is I'm really struggling against. And when I do that, I can understand. We hear a lot of folks sometimes in AA say, you know, people talk to me pretty harsh. And they use the wrong words, and they say the wrong things to me, and they don't take account my feelings. You know those times when Tom and I were standing in the parking lot, and he would get pretty mean to me. He would become pretty mean. The one thing is that when I would go home that night, you know what I remembered when I would walk back into my apartment door after all those times we would be fighting out there in that parking lot? I didn't remember what we had said to each other. I remember the love that I'd felt when he was sitting there harping at me and telling me what I needed to do. So when I brought this up, what I wanted to say is sometimes if you're thinking about it and you're thinking somebody's being kind of hard on you, listen past the words. Because most of us, you know, most of us aren't trained psychologists and we don't know all the right words to say from a modern perspective, but we know what it's like to not know how to not pick up the next drink. Listen past the words. That's where the politically correct stuff comes in sometimes, you know, in the psychobabble. I hear a lot of speakers talk about that, and I wanted to mention this, that I don't really get so worried when I hear somebody using psychological words in meetings. And most of us, when you hear us say we're concerned about it, let me tell you why. It's because those words are easy to hide behind. It's easy to hide behind them and not face the brutal truth. When I want to say, well, I'm depressed and I'm dependent on somebody else, well, sometimes the brutal truth is what you are is you're feeling sorry for yourself because you hadn't been thinking about anybody but yourself, or I hadn't been thinking about anybody but myself, and I hadn't been reaching out and I hadn't been trying to share with anybody else. And that's what it really is. But I want to hide behind, the big words. And that's why when you hear old-timers and when you hear me get mad because you're using the big words, somebody else is using the big words, it's because we know that we can hide behind those. And the simple words work very well. The simple ones work well. And I guess the last thing that I've learned is that after I left Atlanta, where I'd gotten sober and been sober for a long time, and I left behind all the people that I had sponsored and the people that had sponsored me, and that wasn't easy. I left behind a pretty big group of folks. Well, what happened is as soon as I got to Memphis, you know what I did? I was there about a week. Milton called me as soon as I got there, but I was there less than a week, and I got in the car and I went to a meeting. You know, and it's hard when you're first moving to just pick up and go. When I got in the car and I went to a meeting, and I've been going to meetings there ever since, and I go to a lot of meetings while I'm there. I've become involved there just like I did here, and I found people there that can help me just like I found in Atlanta. I know I've not told you everything I wanted to tell you. And I'm sorry if I made you cry. I didn't mean to be sad. I don't think it was sad. It's been a joyful experience. And if you don't think I'm grateful, I really am. I can assure you, and I've embraced this program. So the one thing I'll kind of close on is I told you that Mom and Dad gave me all the tools when I was raised to live with. I never knew how to pick them up and use them. I came in here, you taught me how to be a man, and you taught me how to use those tools. If you're wondering how you did, he's here, just ask him. Thanks so much.